Well, as our participants start coming in virtually to the webinar, I just want to welcome you all to the most recent edition of our Cyber Strategy Chat series. This week, we're going to be talking about something that is near and dear to my heart, not just because it's my chapter in the book, but also because in some ways I've lived this. So today we're going to be talking about cyber strategy and talent. And talent is something that comes up in all of the cyber strategies, whether they're the Department of Defense or the executive's national cyber strategy, even the kind of broader national security strategy and DoD strategy really point to the role that talent and manpower and the future workforce plays in the high technology competition and eventually, hopefully not, conflict. So this is a really wonderful panel that we're going to have today talking about something that is extremely important. So I want to introduce you to our panelists today. We have with us Dr. Chaitra Hardison. Chaitra is a senior behavioral scientist at the RAND Corporation and a member of the PARDI RAND Graduate School. And I really want to commend, she's done work about all sorts of really interesting groups of talent within the Department of Defense. And we'll talk about cyber today, but I highlight her work because I think you should check her on Google because she has some really amazing work that goes beyond the cybersphere. We also have with us today Raj Shah, who is a managing partner of Shield Capital. We have the honor of calling him a visiting fellow here at the Hoover Institution, and he is the former head of the Defense Innovation Unit X, back when it still had an X on it. I actually really enjoyed the X. I thought DIU X sounded a little bit better than DIU. And kind of on a personal level, Raj has some of the same kind of reserve genealogy as me. So Raj is a reservist, a fighter pilot, and he served with my husband, actually, who is a fighter pilot. And we kind of overlapped a little bit, maybe under a man named Bart Gray, who was at Cyber Command and previously kind of living in the tech policy world in the DoD. And finally, we have with us Tim Boer. Tim Boer is HSBC Bank's Global Chief Technology Officer. And he was previously at Colgate and before that at DARPA. And then when he was in the active duty, he was the Deputy Technical Director for the Air Force Red Team. I had the honor of working with Tim as a reservist at West Side Man on the Points of Partnership team, which is a bit of an innovative organization meant to find kind of interesting cyber talent and do outreach with both technical and academic spheres. And we'll talk a little bit about that. We'll talk a little bit about the experience of reservists, the role of reservists. And I want to introduce you a little bit to kind of how we think about talent and manpower in general. So as a good academic, in my chapter of the book, I emphasize not just kind of what's being done today about cyberspace talent, but how cyber talent fits in with our historical understandings of talent, manpower, and warfare. So in the chapter, I go all the way back to the longbow. And this is where I kind of start looking at what are the patterns we see in history. And the longbow is a really interesting analogy for cyber. So when the longbow came onto the warfare scene, it was a really, really cool weapon, right? It allowed for greater ranges, greater accuracy, but it also meant you had to have a very, very skilled archer. These were very difficult weapons to use. And so the states that were adopting the longbow had to build an entire program to develop their talent. So in England, for example, they quickly realized they didn't have enough people who could shoot the longbow. So they invested in archery competitions throughout the country. They changed rules and laws so that even the common folk could have access to the longbow. And they tried to create within essentially the private sector, a kind of talent development. And then they used that talent development to arm the English army with these new weapon systems. Now that is in a big contrast to the development of gunpowder and the development of a very different way of thinking about manpower. Because once we had gunpowder and guns, there wasn't the need for these highly, highly talented group of people. Instead, what countries started looking at was creating more people who had less skill, but that they could then train. And we really saw this acme with levy en masse, where you had these huge armies that Napoleon had built, made up of conscripts. I mean, you're taking farmers and bakers and tailors, and you're giving them a gun. And so the focus in terms of manpower changed. It wasn't about creating very specialized talent and incubating that within the civilian sphere, but instead in training civilians. So it's about rote training and drill. Now, in the cyber world, the world that we're in today, I think the Department of Defense is going to have to start making choices, already is making choices, between am I investing in training the people that are in my force and creating the skills myself, or am I investing in actually creating a flexible workforce and pulling from the civilian sphere? So that is kind of a preface to discussing where we are today when it comes to cyberspace and talent. So I want to start with kind of a big picture. Chaitra, you've looked at personnel and talent issues across the DoD. And I wanted to know from your perspective, how do cyber operators differ from other talent specialties in the military? And then kind of how are they similar? What is this cyber talent thing at all?
Well, that's a really good question. So I've spent quite a bit of time talking to cyber operators. I've talked to cyber officers, and I've talked to some of the enlisted personnel as well, because we've recently done a study on enlisted workforce in addition to our officer study. So your question about how things are similar and different is really relevant, because I've talked to a number of other workforces that the Air Force considers critical and that they have expressed concern about making sure that they're recruiting people and retaining people, including like the remotely piloted aircraft workforce, the nuclear workforce, and so on. And so there are a lot of commonalities in what people talk about across these different different workforces about things that they are concerned about. So some similarities are, you know, people want to be satisfied with their job, and there are certain obstacles to being to that satisfaction, and some of the things that people regularly say that they wish they didn't have to deal with as much is a lot of extra duties and additional work burdens that don't directly relate to what they're trying to accomplish with respect to the mission. So that's something that's common that comes up quite a bit. But there are a number of things that maybe are a little bit more unique to the cyber workforce, including the fact that the cyber workforce is in very high demand outside of the military context. And so there's a lot of draw and reasons why people could go elsewhere if they're unhappy, especially unhappy. Another difference and maybe a similarity with some circumstances is the speed at which technology changes and people's need to keep up with that technology and their desire to. Their cyber personnel are typically people who are really curious and are driven to constant learning because that's the nature of the work. And so one of the things that they really want from their job is the ability to stay current and the ability to keep learning and the ability to have training opportunities that keep them current. And one of the difficulties in a military environment is that the military environment is has more restrictions placed on it than a civilian environment or a non-military private sector kind of environment, and it might take a little bit longer for them to put things in place, and so that can be frustrating to this workforce that really wants to be learning new things.
I want to take that, maybe see if I can take it to the personal level, because Tim, I would identify you as exactly what I think of when I think of cybersecurity talent. And you were quite successful, actually, in the Department of Defense, in, you know, as an active duty military officer working on very cutting edge cyber issues. And you left the active duty. So I want to kind of ask you from a bit of a personal perspective, why? Why did you become a civilian? And what were kind of your motivations for leaving what was kind of a very successful career as an active duty officer and moving into the civilian realm?
Yeah, you know, it was an interesting journey because there was an initial first day. I moved from DARPA, where I had the offensive cyber portfolio, to running the security for Colgate-Palmolive Company. And walking into an IT culture and a the inner sanctum of SCIFs and cyber operations and things like that into a standard commercial environment took a lot of adjustment. But what fundamentally drove that decision for me was a fascination with the applied side of the technology space. And one of the things I found, which was really empowering, really exciting, was that the government had given me not just access to the deepest sources of technology, but also the ability to look around the corner, particularly at DARPA, and see the future that was getting built. And one of the strange things that I've seen the last couple of years is the current digital climate that companies are in mean that every company, the manufacturing companies, they're all digital companies now. They all understand that. But that requires, particularly the boards of those companies, want to go into the future with confidence. That requires deeply understanding security and not actually understanding it, but trusting someone who they feel confident understands not just vulnerabilities and windows or ways that people can exert control over systems, but how do you move into things like distributed trust with, say, things like blockchains or whatever else is crypto systems, cryptocurrencies that rely on really technical foundations? And I think the COVID climate, watching companies go, say, 10 years, jump 10 years ahead in their direct-to-consumer plans, for example, and move a lot of their sales to direct infrastructure that they're controlling, all this requires a level of tech understanding that I think CISOs didn't have before. And the last part of that that is a real interesting opportunity is the adoption of cloud computing. When organizations had essentially an on-premise data center, they needed an army of people to keep the beast running. And so you could have a lot of mid-level skill and traditional IT support desk kind of skills running that operation. As organizations move into someone else's infrastructure that the cloud presents, you can move a lot faster if you have the talent that has to go to that next deepest level of understanding, because the cloud brings in all this complexity. It's supposed to be someone else's computer and supposed to be simpler, but the reality is you have a whole family of processors you can use. You don't have a 10-year contract with an IBM to run a data center. You have the ability to move your workloads amongst different public clouds. And so for me, there was kind of an initial, I'd say, slow start of what is this world to a kind of rapidly expanding set of opportunities where there was an incredible demand for people that could boldly go into these spaces that were really governed by advanced technology.
We want to take that opportunity to pivot to Raj, because Raj, you are talent. But you also managed an innovative organization where you had to build your talent from the bottom up. And you had some real weird complexities that I think like a normal startup company wouldn't have to deal with. You had to manage your talent within the confines of DoD personnel regulations, both civilian and military. And so I'm really interested to hear from your perspective, how does an organization that's its core competency is actually talent, but it's a DoD organization, how did you deal with the challenge of building talent within DIU X at the time?
Yeah, thanks, Jackie. And we You've even roped in Tim a little bit there. You know, I think we were very fortunate at the DIUX days to have an incredible range of talent, folks from the private sector, folks from government, uniform members to come together. And so maybe I would, you know, I can talk about some of the tactical things, but to sort of address your broader question, right? So what does the top talent want? You know, it's in cyber, which is in such demand across all organizations, right? It is a war for talent. And the DoD and the national security, you know, complex is just one of many suitors. And so if you think about it, what's going to bring a person to you? It's, you know, it's first and foremost, it's the mission. It's the other people that they're working with. And then thirdly, you know, compensation. But I would say that third piece is actually the lesser of them all to really get good talent. And I think the overlay, of course, all of that is when it's a war for talent, how do you make it simple? And so I think one of the, you know, the advantages that we had of starting something new is we got to build the team that we want. So we had really an A-plus team of folks. You know, in fact, you talked a little bit about the point of presence cyber team. We took two folks out of there, two colonels, Mike McGinley and Ernie Bayer. We brought them over. Then we began to hire people out of Google. We brought some people from the Pentagon. So we had really had a solid team. But most importantly, when they showed up on day one, they were able to work on the mission, right? So why do people go and do public service? It's the mission. It's really exciting. So we were able to take a lot of the friction points out. Like, you don't have to wait 3 weeks to get a laptop or 4 weeks to get an email address. Like, you're ready to go on day one. You don't have to have an ID card plugging into a, you know, system from the 1980s to be able to actually do any work, right? We had modern laptops. So these small little things, though, you know, were really important. You know, instead of taking 6 months to start the job after we've told you we want you, right? Maybe you can start in 30 days. And so anyway, so we were able to bring this folks together, and then we had the flexibility where people could leave and come back and vice versa. So I think all those things together is really critical for the Department of Defense to think about if it wants to win in this war for talent.
You know, it's funny. I've spoken in a few public venues about this talent issue. And every single time I talk about the Defense Travel System, DTS, which if anybody here has worked with DTS knows, it is the most god-awful travel voucher system you've ever dealt with in your entire life. And generally, I get laughs of recognition, like we've all gone through that pain. But I also get a little of a dismissal. When I say, hey, we have technology problems, I shouldn't have to spend 30 minutes trying to find a PDF that works on my Mac. I shouldn't have to download an entirely new operating system on a Mac in order to get into a kind of unclassified .mil website that I need for personnel records. So the kind of lack of investment in technology for administrative purposes comes up every time we talk about talent. And Chaitra, you actually, this is something that, you know, Raj, Tim, and I have all experience in reserves, but this is not exclusive to the reserves. This is something that you found as well when you did your interviews of Air Force cyber operators. How important was technological support for admin to keeping talent in the DoD?
Well, you know, as you talk about the frustrations, I mean, people talk about the fact that there are a wide range of existing legacy systems in the Air Force, and how the Air Force is structured in a way where those legacy systems remain, and so that can be frustrating to people. So I want to point out that even though there's these frustrations that you're mentioning, I did sort of I led with the things that people talk about frustrations, but on the other hand, they do talk about you know, how important the mission is to them. And so the people who stay talk about these inconveniences that they face that are faced by everybody in every career field, just as you're saying, the travel system, everybody has to deal with the travel system. Everybody has to do lots and lots of, you know, force-wide training, and everybody has to deal with, you know, the bureaucracy of decision-making and how things get put in and paperwork and so on. And so even though all of that is there, and even though all of those frustrations are there, the people that we talked about how, while they'd like to change those things, it's, and to Raja's point, it's the mission and that keeps them there, because they've been offered, you know, huge salaries to leave. And so, you know, one of the things that they talk about wanting to do is to try to sort of change things from within to make it better, so that their peers who are drawn away, you know, come back. But to your point, I mean, there were a number of things that they talked about where there are systems in place that just seem like, you know, there ought to be a better way of doing things. And I will say too that these systems and these things that are in place, I know that leadership is listening to these issues, but it's a slow process of making these changes. And in the private sector world, again, because the private sector, they can make a change on a dime. And that's one of the things that they do for competitive advantage. But the military doesn't make changes on a dime like that. And so it takes a little bit longer for these comments about like the travel system to be able to find their way into getting fixed. So I don't know if that answered your question, but.
So I know Tim's going to jump in. I will say, I feel like they can turn on a faster dime, and they have chosen not to prioritize it. Sometimes I get comments like, well, the mission is really important and y'all are being snowflakes, so just chill. But instead, they're investing in really expensive weapon systems instead of people. Well, and I think that might be part of the issue, is a bit of a prioritization of resources.
Or spending four times as much for DTS instead of using Concur or some commercially available solution in that particular case, for example. Sorry.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So I, you know, I agree about this idea, because certainly there are people who say, you know, don't complain, but I want to raise a point. You know, in response to anybody who says, you know, just stop complaining. The idea is that, you know, while, and I want to point out that anytime I go talk to people and go and hold interviews with people, I'm asking them, I'm soliciting from them, what are your, you know, what are the things that you could change if you could? They're not necessarily coming to me and, you know, and complaining. I'm asking them, if you could change things, what would you change? You know, what are the sources of dissatisfaction? And the reason why we're asking that is because if you want to be able to retain the best and the best talent, because those are the many of the people who will leave. You know, you get people leaving across the entire spectrum, but certainly people who are the top of the top, best of the best, have lots and lots and lots of opportunities out there. So if, you know, in an organization, if you want to retain people in general, and if you want to retain the best people, because you could have the right numbers, but if you're losing, you know, some of your best personnel to the civilian world, that's a problem. So if you want to retain people, you need to address what their sources of dissatisfaction are. And so it's worth asking the question. So even if people are complaining, and even if it's something that everybody feels like, well, just, you know, you should just deal with it. You know, the point is, you want to try to set up a situation where people are happy. Because people's perceptions matter, and it will drive their behavior.
I guess I'll take a slightly contrarian view, which is cybersecurity is such a complex issue where it is the what's happening in the private sector is just as important as what's happening in the government sector, if not more. That if the government's view is just they want to retain all their talent, they're going to get an adverse selection bias, and the good people are going to leave, and they'll be left with the people that couldn't get jobs. And so I think that's actually I would not recommend that, more of that approach, sort of foolhardy. My view is the government should encourage its best folks to leave and go to the private sector, but then find ways for them to come back very quickly and or stay connected through the reserves, be they military reserves or some sort of civilian reserve system. And, you know, your best folks, let them go leave, let them go to a startup, let them go to a big company like Google, let them do what Tim did and be a CISO at major companies. But then, hey, let them come back and maintain their clearances and maintain their records in the personnel system. So if they want to come back and spend another couple of years, they can. And I think that's additionally very important when you think about cybersecurity, because, and as you know, the threat is changing so quickly. And the types of technologies are changing so fast that if either side spends too much time in just one sector, they're going to get stale, particularly from the technical standpoint.
Actually, if I could just jump in really quickly, I don't actually disagree with what Raj just said. It's one of the things that was suggested by personnel was an opportunity to go out into the private sector and to come back. And traditionally, the military hasn't had a way of doing that. Not just back into a reserve role, but actually back into active duty. So finding a way to allow people to go out, have that career for some period of time and come back would be ideal.
So I want to push on that just a little bit, because actually three of us on this call are reservists and who have used this flexible opportunity to serve. But there are challenges, because I often hear, especially when people don't know I'm a reservist and I brief that we have talent issues, they say, oh, but we can use the reserves. And then I always hear the story about the airman who works at, who's like a senior like operator at Google. And I kind of roll my eyes a little bit, because actually, as these people are, it's actually a very small community. And they're not always used appropriately within the reserve. So I want to get you guys' opinions about what is the role of the military reserve? What's the difference? Raj, you brought up the civilian reserve corps, which is actually one of the recommendations that came out of the National Artificial Intelligence Security Commission. So what is, you know, the idea behind military reserves versus civilian reserves? And then kind of what is the opportunities we can use with this reserve idea? And I think especially pragmatically, what are the challenges here?
Yeah, no, it's great. I think it's a huge, huge opportunity for the DoD to do something like a civilian reserves. And I'll let Tim opine too, because I know he's got some thoughts on this. But you know, the opportunity of having this cadre of folks that are still connected, still vetted, still cleared, that are working in the private sector offers so much opportunity, right? It offers a ready group of people that when interesting jobs and opportunities open up inside the government, they could come back full time for a period of time. But in a time of conflict or in a time of sudden attack, you again now have a ready force that you can call upon. And you know, we have similar things on the military side, but again, much of our cyber talent force is in the private sector, and you can a civilian force gets outside of many of the restrictions. You know, there's a lot of folks that are great engineers that maybe don't want haircuts as often, or you know, have other issues. And so, this is a chance to broaden our pool to say, look, we know we need to get access to this group. But I love your Tim has to think.
Well, and I think back to when, you know, when I first met Raj, the decision to say, hey, I have to work with this guy, really comes down to smart people want to work with other smart people. There's a real cultural component. The mission is the mission. You have to expose it, let it be what it is. But the two things that you can fix are culture and availability or bias towards action. And I think those two things, Raj built a team. He just talked about smart people. That was great. The mission was there, but the ability to remove the BS and let you see results is key. Because if there's one thing people want, once the culture is enough and the mission is enough, they want to be useful and they want to be able to get things done. One story of mine with the tools and the overhead support of everything that the reservists have to use to stay current, I've written a set of shell scripts. So I do everything from the command line to say Workday and it using Selenium and headless browsers. It gets past all the annoying requirements of I need to have this 10-year-old browser on this old computer to connect to this system. And it does that all automatically for me. So I can do all my security reporting, everything else. Those are things people are willing to do, willing to write shell scripts to automate around systems that are too painful to use. because the mission's that important. If you have a good boss and a good culture, you'll figure out how to work around those. So keeping the first principle in the first place, which is let people do cool things and get out of their way and let them build the right culture that puts smart people together and lets them like fully exercise that the talent that they have. I think we're bad at that in a lot of ways by essentially putting like 100-pound backpacks on people that want to run. And I've seen that in a lot of cases in the reserves generally.
I love that analogy of the you just want to run and they want you to run too, but they're putting the backpack on you. So I think that's very accurate. If I wasn't reticent to show you the mess that is my life around me, I would show you the computer I have set up to try and do government things, which unfortunately automatically updated. And now I can't actually use the websites that I need. I will have to find a way to download those old versions of Internet Explorer. So
we
I wanted to
start.
Kim, I wish you lived closer. I'm, you know, I work in the cyber talent range, but I will admit I am a political scientist before everything, and I do struggle with the tech. So whatever time it takes Tim, it takes me probably 10 times the amount of time to get that figured out. So I want to get to some of this kind of really great discussion that's happening within the question and answer. And I want to ask about the alignment of values and how that affects recruitment. And I think this is particularly apropos today because there's a recent survey that came out that showed that trust in the military as an institution has gone down almost 25% in the last 3 years. And there has been a lot of discussion about extremism, about gender, about sexuality and culture in general. So, and I think sometimes the tech community is known for being extremely open, maybe even leaning towards liberal. Is there a misalignment of values? Or is that kind of a misconception? And how does that idea of values affect the recruitment of talent into the military, especially when it comes to cyber?
I'd love to take a stab at that. You know, the interesting thing working in between the spaces, there is an incredibly different diversity baseline. The commercial world I'm in is big international bank. So naturally, 90% of my workforce are not U.S. citizens and, you know, represent the diversity of the countries they come from, particularly with a very strong Asian component in a East-West bank that's there. But one of the things that I've found is there are certain universal values that translate well. And one of the core things I've had to do with my teams is to retain that sense of mission focus we have in the DoD that in corporate environments doesn't come as naturally. Everyone in a corporate environment wants to do well in the system they're in, but instilling that sense of mission and asking that question of what is the mission of our team? And one of the things that's nice about this subspace, this bubble of cyber, is that in companies, there's a very righteous ability to control a company's assets and to help the business have freedom of action in light of all these threats that come up. And that means two things. One is you have an ability to be integral to all acquisitions, business decisions, technologies that get generated a lot of time on the product side to make sure particularly the digital products are secure. Things like digital toothbrushes that connect to your phone, lots of stories on that kind of stuff. But the other part of that is amongst commercial security leadership, even in the most competitive industries, there's an intense collaborative spirit. I'm on so many different Signal and WhatsApp groups with every CISO knows every other CISO out there. And when there's a threat, regardless of where one sits in industry, you share that because it's us against the bastards that are out there. And we want to keep control of our systems and we want to fight in that same sense that you take that military mission forward. So I found at a certain high level, there is a real commonality and a real kind of righteousness to the work, even if it's not inside that national security community.
Yeah, maybe I'll chime in and you know, second what Tim is saying. I think that the culture piece of it is so important, and there are more similarities than differences. I think the real problem, though, is a lack of perception or understanding between those two worlds, right? And so, Jacket, you're right. Like most engineers, I would guess, that are here in the Bay Area, more often than not, they'll certainly be on the more liberal progressive side. But they don't understand that, look, the Department of Defense and National Security, they're apolitical. It's an apolitical organization. You have people of all types. But they read headlines and news stories and movies that, you know, indicate to them, or they come to the conclusion that this is not a place where they would fit in, where it's this opposite of the truth. And I think the core problem set here, and which is why I think, again, there's a macro value to having reservists, both military or civilian, is just this personal relationship gap, right? These two worlds just don't intermix. The DoD, for probably very reasonable cost cutting and saving measures, have shuttered every active duty base in the Bay Area. There are no more left, right? So there is no opportunity for a young middle schooler or high schooler to interact with students whose parents serve and have dinners and go to church and like have those conversations. And so you don't have that, I think, that personal touch. And so I think this is where the reserves in particular play a broader role in that civil divide.
Just to add to this idea about people not necessarily knowing about what life is like in the military and working in a military organization, you know, there is this disconnect for people who have never been exposed to it, who don't know anybody in the military. They don't have an understanding for the fact that even though there may be this perception that people can't speak out and have their voice heard, it's actually really quite the opposite, that people do feel very comfortable speaking their opinion and leadership is looking for input and opinions. And so there is this, I think, perception about what life is like working in the military that may be wrong. And the diversity, to the point about diversity, when you think about diversity of viewpoints and opinions, there's quite a wide range of people's views that that get expressed in the military, and that's supported. I think it's worth pointing out that many of the beliefs that people have, if they've had no experience or exposure to the military, that are based purely on movies, about what life is like in the military, might be misleading.
One quick thing I'd say was, in the military, I've experienced different work environments. And when I moved to DC, was the first opportunity to really work alongside the commercial world. So we worked in Roslyn, Virginia. Today I'm working in the Crystal City area. And I think one of the challenges, and Raj highlighted it really well, the way we physically base, because of cost constraints, you have mega bases developing, and they might be in Dayton, Ohio, where my hometown has experienced a lot of growth with a base there. But unfortunately, that means less and less of the population interacts with people that are in the military.
Hey, Tim, we lost you for like 30 seconds.
Oh, no. Sorry.
Yeah.
It's my hotel Wi-Fi. So I was just saying I'd experienced two different paradigms of on a base that's outside of any urban environment, for example, where your whole network and community is there inside that base. Versus moving to DC is probably the one place where civilian and military people actually mix together in a city environment. And that ability to have lunch, people in uniform, people from banking or from tech or from everything else getting together, is a really empowering experience. And I think we need to think about that more as we integrate, particularly talent in this area. It's not served well by using either classification or physical location, there are a number of things that create barriers inside a tech talent community. And I think very specifically focusing on those barriers and doing our best to remove those is best for both sides engaged.
I want to get a little bit into the weeds here. Tim, you work in the cybersecurity community. And I think one of the things that is a really, really big difference between civilian cybersecurity and the way the military at least organizes and thinks about cybersecurity is that the military kind of thinks all cybersecurity is the same. I mean, they know it's not. But when they define their core specialties, so in the military, there are these things called military operational specialties. In the Air Force, it's Air Force specialty codes. And then in the Navy, it's a series of designators that are so confusing that even after working for the Navy for 3 years, I really couldn't explain to you. But they identify kind of who you are in the military, what your skill set is. And it also identifies what training you're required to have and what jobs you're qualified for. It also goes to promotion. So the Air Force, for example, has created this thing called the 17 Delta, which is kind of a cyber officer. But the reality of cyber is that it's not the cyber. In fact, there's a lot of different types of specialties. So I'd love to hear from Tim and Chaitra. Are we organizing appropriately? How do we need to think about dealing or recruiting or training the very specific types of skills that really are part of what is cybersecurity?
I'll dive in. This is a topic I feel really passionately on, that I'm an aerospace engineer by training with degrees in astro-aero engineering and master's in math. I think that has prepared me more for cyber than if I had a mission information systems degree or had been through the cyber-focused training. I think one of the challenges is the cyber world really has two distinct communities. There's an engineering tech science community, and there's a program management and IT kind of support community. When the Air Force creates a specific name for a cyber person and has specific cyber training, I think that IT and comm, plug in the wires, connect the systems community, then gets confused with the background of what we see as cyber is the ability to control systems and ensure exclusive control means you understand everything about that system, to include the way it manages memory, the way it interacts with the physical world, all these things. And a Microsoft Windows Network certification is not going to be the way to be able to get that type of insight. And so I think by naming it, you actually diminish the talent that can kind of come in and take that kind of approach from the side that you have to take with cyber, because you can't ever define the exact skills needed for it other than the ability to fully understand the complex system that you're actually working with.
To add to that, you talked about how there's Air Force specialty codes and military occupational specialties in the Army, and you know there's a different name for it in each of the military services. But to your point about the existence of this one career field, that was one of the things that officers talked a lot about in our study, about this idea that there are different kinds of activities that people are engaged in, and that this by grouping everybody together into one single career field, it creates a communication problem, both at, you know, at the point of recruiting people, but also once people enter training, because people might be hoping that they're going to go into one area of the specialty, and it turns out they end up in another one, and so it you know can create disappointment when people are you know hoping for one type of work. The different domains include things that are sort of IT or support or building systems side of things, and that's the Department of Defense Information Network element of the work. And then there's these offensive and defensive roles, and each of those is distinctly different. And then of course there are what systems are you working on, and so even if you break it apart into those different separate elements, where you've got offensive people, you've got defensive people, and you have people who are working to support the networks and build them, then you still have to ask the question, how do you make sure that you're developing people appropriately so that they're skilled in a particular area, and that area may require that you track people and keep them in a position for longer and give them opportunities for training that are specific to what they're doing. Even within the defensive operations, for example, area, there might be specific lines of training that one person needs and a different defensive person doesn't need. And so recognizing this and having a flexible system and a system that also allows people to stay in that role for a longer period of time to develop that depth of expertise is something that they talked about too.
I want to ask a bit of a question because I kind of delve into this just a tiny bit more, which is the three of us on here that are military are officers. And there is actually there's a very large distinction in what officers and enlisted are expected to do, how we billet out the structure. But this is not a concept that exists really in the civilian world. I mean, there are managers and there are doers, but it's not this clear divide that has existed in the military. Is that useful? Or is that an impediment to thinking about how we use the cyber force in the military?
Well, so I'll say that the officers talked a lot about this. So they talked a lot about the concerns with wanting to stay. I mean, people talk about wanting to stay on keyboard, wanting to stay technical, wanting to be able to actually execute the work themselves. And that the idea for some of them of moving on to a management role, for some people, that's what they wanted. That's typically where officers go, is they move into management roles fairly quickly, and then they do less of the hands-on work. But a lot of the people in cyber really want to stay on keyboard and keep doing the work. And it's very similar. People do a lot of comparisons to another workforce in the Air Force, the pilots who want to fly. And the Air Force does allow pilots to fly for an extended period of time because they need people to fly aircraft. And also, pilots want to fly. And so the idea here is if officers do want to stay on keyboard, giving them an opportunity to stay in that role before moving on to management for a lot longer of their career might be beneficial because if they're moved into management, In the civilian world, you can stay in your technical job indefinitely and never move on to management. You know, people won't force you into that kind of a role. And so allowing for some of that flexibility where some people just want to stay technical for an extended period of time in their career might be beneficial.
I will say, if pilot is the analogy, we're in a world of hurt because pilots have their own really, really awful retention story happening, where quite often they do want to fly more. They've been trained for many years, and yet because of the way promotion structures are created, pilots don't get nearly as much time flying as they would like. And it's interesting, Raj went from managing DIUX to now flying again in the reserves. So I feel like you've actually kind of like figured it out, Raj, like how to be a senior person, but then just fly. Kudos to you. Sorry, Tim, I know you were waiting.
No, it's awesome. I just think in the world of cyber, having run teams of hackers, I was blown away at the kind of high octane meritocracy that exists in cyber. The most meritocratic place in the world is probably the floor of DEF CON, where the capture the flag exercise is happening. It doesn't matter at all what your education background is. You have to be able to traverse in a territory that only, you know, a millionth of a percent of the world can kind of go into. One of my best hackers, we hired right out of high school, didn't get his high school diploma. It was too poor, didn't have access to a computer, but he had printed the source code of Windows on a binder, used his school printer to do it. So had a 1,000-page binder, was going through the binary, the decompiled binary, the Windows source code, finding exploits without access to a computer. And this kind of diamond in the rough model, he shouldn't come in and say, well, he doesn't have a college degree, so he's enlisted, so he can't do this or can't do that. The space needs to let talent be, and any distinction on that, whether it's AFSC or enlisted officer age or anything else, should should really fall away somehow because it doesn't help.
Yeah, it's a good point that Tim makes, right? And so when you think about cyber, I'd almost think about two different categories, right? You've got a group of folks that are going to be utilizing tools for offensive or defensive purpose. In that case, the military structures and management processes and training processes that have been proven for you know, centuries and millennia actually make a lot of sense. And it's, you know, it's warfare in a different domain. But then there's the group that's actually creating new things and developing new tools. And it's not just tools that they can hand over, right? They're very, very exquisite. And I think in that segment, what the person's educational background, where they were from, does not actually correlate with perhaps how good they are. And we need a different structure. And that's, I think, to your point, Jackie, the current structure kind of falls apart. And perhaps this is where the civilian component, both reserve or full-time, will find a way to champion, protect, and grow that talent, because it's a very, very technical discipline. And there's only so many people in the world that can do it.
One thing I want to add that's made me also think about, when you've got officers and enlisted, a lot of times the distinction is the officers serve in a more managerial kind of capacity, and the enlisted are the ones executing some of the work. But in the case of cyber, one of the things that everybody talked about, enlisted and officers, is that really understanding what's going on in cyber, having that technical expertise, is really important for decision making. And so for leadership, when you move into these leadership roles eventually later in your career, for a leader to have that deep technical expertise will help them make better decisions about how to use cyber, and about understanding risk within the context of cyber. And so having officers who have that depth of technical expertise, it would require that they stay current, because that technical expertise, it degrades it and expires because technology is constantly changing. And so this is a little bit different than some other career fields, which may be where the officers might be more hands-off and it might be less of a problem for the decision-making.
Well, that brings us to 9 minutes left in our conversation, which brings us into the lightning round, which is where I ask you questions that require lots of nuance and discussion, but ask you to answer them very simply with almost like yes or no's. And so this allows us to get through a lot of conversation in a short period of time. So if you guys don't mind going off mute, Raj's like, oh,
yeah.
Okay. So if I have to pick one word to be the motto for DoD, for DoD cyber talent, is it retainment or recruitment?
Recruitment.
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 All right. Innovation units. We have a lot of these now. Does the DoD have too many or not enough?
Too many.
Yeah, I'd say too many.
That's outside my expertise.
I think you just stick with the originals, right, Raj?
I won't say nuance, but the reason I say too many is that it gives senior leaders an excuse to not do innovation because they can just point to their innovation unit.
Absolutely agree. And as being part of an innovation unit that ultimately probably failed, I also think that we don't often look at kind of what about innovation units works for us and what does not. We also have a hard time killing units in general. Not that I'm advocating for any unit to die. I have a few in my mind, but I won't put them out here, right here. All right. So speaking of new units, the United States has just stood up a new force, the Space Force. Should there be a cyber force?
I'm unsure, because it would be a lot of bureaucracy and a lot of structure. And I think we have a lot to do. And I think that would distract us for a while, that we have to clear out barriers now, as opposed to building new structure.
I would say, let's start with a cyber academy and then think about a force later.
So I will say that cyber is in every military service. It's relevant in every military service. So you can't extract it out of all of them and put it someplace else. But there already is a heavy cyber force in the Air Force, and it's part of what the Air Force's mission is. And that was the same way that space was. So there is, you know, space used to be in the Air Force, and the Air Force used to do space. So there already is, in some sense, a cyber force.
So as a academic, we're all looking for these things called natural experiments, in which we are able to get leverage on an intellectual question because the paths naturally diverge because of like maybe one variable. And so here, as an academic, I'm particularly interested in kind of the future of space force versus whether there is a cyber force, and actually kind of the difference between the cyber mission forces, which is very joint, and space force. And we will see in the end what succeeds the best. Okay, so in the aircrew field that Raj is in, there is a lot of debate about retention based on bonuses. Do pilots stay in because of bonuses? And they have a rather large bonus. A lot of career fields have bonuses. Cyber has kind of experimented with this. So what do you guys think? Cyber bonuses, are those useful for the force or not?
So I'll go first. I think that some people are motivated by bonuses. And I think some people, it doesn't matter how much money you offer, are not going to make their decision on the basis of money. But I think it's worth having them for some people.
I'd say it's worthwhile to the extent that it's a signal of value inside the organization. I got an engineering bonus when I was a young second lieutenant, and it motivated the hell out of me. It's like, wow, okay, they really want me to be here. And I think that might have pushed me to stay past that initial commitment I had from college.
I think it's an important tool, but there are so many more tools that you could pull before. So I wouldn't say don't do it. Yeah, of course, let's do it. It's important. But that's probably easier than some of the more structural reforms required if you really want to attract and retain the right talent.
Okay. In our conversation, we've talked a lot about the military reserve and a little bit about the civilian reserve. But there does seem to be a bit of a competing focus, at least in all these commissions that have stood up, between investing more in the military reserve or investing more in the civilian reserve. When it comes to cybersecurity, what do you think in the long term is going to be more useful for the Department of Defense? Investing in a new civilian reserve or putting more emphasis and investment into the existing military reserve?
I'll start first saying I think the civilian reserve makes a lot of sense because the military, it has this 20-year sprint that you're in as a career, and you have a lot of gates and a lot of things you should be doing, like the military schools and all those other things that I think aren't necessarily helpful to this idea of bringing talent in and out, because the talent that comes in for a short time won't have had all those pieces that it's not as readily available to have people pop in and out of military as it is from a civilian perspective can be.
Yeah, I'd say both. I mean, I think the civilian reserve has the most potential, but it's also the hardest to do because it's something new. We already have a military reserve, so it's easier to get going. So the pragmatist me says, I can go to the military side. The more optimist would say, let's focus on the civilian side.
I think I'd probably have to say both too. I mean, the idea of opening up new ideas and new ways of using personnel and attracting people and retaining them is good.
Okay, I want to ask a little question. We didn't talk about physical fitness, but physical fitness is something that comes up in this conversation a lot about manpower. In fact, the Army just developed a new physical fitness test, which has gotten a lot of congressional scrutiny because it's difficult to set up. It seems to actually weed out a lot of women. And we've had a bunch of debates about whether physical fitness is really important for the cyber military corps. So what do you think? Does the cyber military corps need to continue doing its physical fitness test, or can we have different standards for the cyber components of the services?
I'll say, the main challenge of the physical fitness test is just, and you probably relate to this as well, the logistical concern. It's insanely, it's the hardest thing to do. And it's never been a challenge because the standards are very general for those tests, at least I've found coming from a military background. I think coming in from the outside, maybe they're different or maybe there's something that the type of people you'd recruit wouldn't see
and,
that.
And we are, the three of us are all Air Force, so we kind of have golf club standards as opposed to like the Army or the Marines.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, I mean, healthiness of your workforce is, of course, important. And I think that is important, and it's part of the military culture. But I would agree with Tim; it is just one more distraction, and that's going to push people away. And it's not the physical fitness part of it; it's signing up and going through the hoops,
getting a time on a base somewhere that you can, like, basically, you have to beg, borrow, or steal someone to let you in at their fitness unit because you're not really with a group of people that has you can go get your dental sign off from your local dentist, but you can only do the fitness test with an actual team and always show up as, who's that guy? Just please sign the paperwork. I'm going to do this. So it is a challenge, but I think it, if you looked at a civilian requirement, I think the best thing to do is look at where the good talent is. And none of those places would have a physical, the thought that would be part of retention or part of, say, culture at Google or something like that. And the reason it wouldn't be is because it'd be hard to make a story on how it's relevant to the work that would come out of it. So I think that helps understand whether it's necessary or not, other than the cultural components.
There has to be something, we do have to acknowledge the issue of culture and the military organizations and the idea of the possibility of deployment and the possibility of insider threats and so on, and so there is an argument that can be made for why military personnel might need a different standard of physical fitness, and certainly I think that's part of the discussion. You need a force that's always ready. You need a force that's healthy and able to do the work. And so arguments can be made for why it should be included.
So on that note, I think it's time for me to go do some push-ups. I really want to thank this extraordinary panel for this discussion. And then for those of you who have been following this series all along, next week we are going to be featuring a discussion that's very similar to this on public-private partnerships and innovation. So we will have the honor of having with us Dr. Amy Ziegert, Dr. Joe Felter, Dr. Peter Dombrowski, and Dr. Erica Borgard. So it is going to be a wonderful discussion. Thank you all for joining us today. Mm-hmm.